It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
The show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
we have, until this past July, had one of the lowest rates of financial support for foster families in the entire country. It was abysmal. Now, we are improving that. We have already started to make improvements to it, and more improvements will be coming, and I think that will help. But we just don't have enough families willing to take kids, and those who are willing to take in kids are more likely to want younger children.
Attorney Christy Mara at the Virginia Poverty Law Center speaks for children in foster care who are trapped in what a recent study by the Pew Charitable Trust has called the worst foster care system in the nation. And if you need repairs in rental housing, you'll find out how to get that done legally in our weekly question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. This show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Last month, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights Act to protect consumers from abusive lending practices by credit card companies. With strong bipartisan support, the bill passed by a vote of 312 to 112 and prohibits credit card lending practices that trap consumers in a vicious cycle of debt. These abusive practices include applying interest rate hikes to balances incurred under older, lower rates, assessing hidden and unjustified interest charges on balances already paid off, requiring consumers to pay off balances with lower interest rates before those with higher interest rates, charging late fees even when consumers mail their payment 7 days in advance of the due date, and charging excessive upfront fees on cards targeted at consumers with poor credit. The bill now heads to the U.S. Senate, where passage is less certain, but may not matter, since the Federal Reserve Board already has proposed regulations similar to those in the bill and can enforce those regulations without congressional approval. In other news, the Virginia Board of Education revised the state's regulations for special education students last month and omitted two proposals that parents of disabled students had said would severely restrict their rights. The board dropped a plan to allow schools to eliminate services without parental consent and decided not to switch appeals of special education decisions from the courts to the Department of Education. Although it received a record-breaking 38,000 comments, the board did not revise other unpopular proposals. Despite opposition, the board removed certain requirements for including parents in the disability evaluation process and kept the rule that schools complete those evaluations within 65 business days, about a month longer than federal law dictates. The revised regulations now head to the governor's office for review. The final 30-day comment period ends October 25. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright.
Hang on.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is child neglect and abuse. Child neglect or abuse is an immediate threat to a child's health or life, which is so great that severe or incurable injury would likely result. Except in an emergency, a child can be removed from the home only by a court order, and only after the court finds that reasonable efforts have been made to prevent the child's removal, but nothing else will protect the child. Within 5 business days of a child's removal from the home, a preliminary removal hearing must be held. Both parents must get court papers telling them the date, time, and place of the hearing, and must be given a chance to say their side of the story to a judge. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Term of the Week.
We turn once again to our weekly question and answer session, and we have a questioner in the studio with us. Tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Brian. I'm from Goochland County.
Welcome to the show, Brian. Tell us your question for this week.
I have a question about my landlord. If there's anything legally I can do to make him do the repairs to the place I'm staying at this present time.
And what seems to be the problem, and how long has it been there?
The bathroom floors are rotten. They're sinking in. The air conditioner broke. He said he's going to buy a new unit for the air conditioner, and he hasn't done anything about it.
All right, and 2 more questions. Number one, are you current in your rent?
Yes, I am.
And second, have you given the landlord any type of notice in writing?
No, I have not.
All right, we get this question a lot, and to get repairs done in Virginia, a tenant has to do 3 things. First, you have to be current in your rent and stay current. Second, you have to give a written notice to your landlord about what the problem is, or make sure that someone else, like the building inspector, has given written notice on your behalf. Third, you have to wait a reasonable period of time for the landlord to make the repairs. The law doesn't really set forth a reasonable period of time, but typically that's going to be 21 to 30 days unless it's a true emergency situation like no heat in the winter or bad plumbing leak or no electricity or something like that, in which case it could be a matter of days or even hours. Now, if you do all 3 of those things, you're current in your rent, you stay current, you give written notice or someone else provides written notice for you, and you wait a reasonable period of time, and the landlord still has not made those repairs, the law does provide you a remedy, and it is the only remedy allowed by Virginia law. You're not allowed to withhold your rent. You're not allowed to make the repairs and deduct the costs from your rent. What you have to do, your only remedy, is to take your next month's rent and the notice that you gave the landlord, take it to your local general district court, and file what's called a tenant's assertion. And you pay your next month's rent into court. You get a court date probably in about 3 weeks, and the judge who hears the case can do any number of things. The judge can order some or all of the rent money returned to you, or all of or some of the rent money paid to the landlord, or can order the money held by the court until the landlord makes the repairs, or if you wish, can even end your lease entirely. Do those sound like reasonable remedies for you?
Hey, yes, they do. That's a big help. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you much for being on the show. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. And we're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center talking with Christy Mara who is an expert on foster care. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're most welcome. This is a topic that's been quite in the news, and Virginia has been cited as having, quote, the worst foster care system in the nation, and we'll get into why that might be so later on. But first, tell us, what is foster care, and why would a child end up in foster care?
Well, Marty, foster care is the broad term that we use for state care of children who are previously in homes where there was some neglect of them by their caretakers or some actual physical abuse of them by their caretakers. In order to wind up in foster care, the family has to go through the court process, and that is generally the juvenile and domestic relations court process.
Now, you mentioned that a child could be removed from the home because of neglect or abuse. I think we're all probably pretty familiar with what abuse means, but what are we talking about by neglect?
Neglect can be a variety of different things, but basically, if you look at the legal standard, a court is going to find that a child is being neglected if the child is at risk of some substantial harm, either physical harm or mental harm, as a result of the things that he or she is not getting in the home. And so we're talking about whether or not the child's basic needs are being met. Do they have adequate shelter? Do they have adequate food? Are their medical needs being met? But most often what we see, and we see a lot of children removed from neglect. If you look at the statistics, far more than 50% of the kids who wind up in foster care in Virginia wind up there because there's been a finding that their parents are neglecting them. What we see, if we look behind those figures, is that most kids who are being, quote, neglected are living with parents who are suffering from an addiction to some type of substance.
I see. So how does this court removal process work? Lead us through it sort of step by step.
Generally, what will happen is somebody, some anonymous person, will make a complaint to their local child protective services unit. And then a social worker from that unit will go out and investigate. And if the social worker finds that there's some imminent danger to the child, she will actually file an affidavit stating her findings under oath. That affidavit will be reviewed by a juvenile court judge, and that judge can issue what's called an emergency removal order without the parent ever knowing that that process has taken place, and that child can be taken from the parent. Now, there has to be another hearing within 5 days with 24-hour notice to the parent. And that notice has to state not only that the child has been removed, but why. And then the parent has an opportunity to come forward and respond to the allegations.
So even though in an extreme emergency case, a child could be removed without the parent even knowing that a case had been filed or why the removal, there has to be a hearing in 5 days. I imagine it's pretty important that the parent go to that hearing fully prepared and possibly with an attorney?
It is essential that the parent go to the hearing as well prepared as possible, given the brief amount of notice. Remember, it's only 24-hour notice that's required to that parent, so they can be but so much prepared for that. They should have an attorney. If they cannot afford an attorney, state law gives them a right to have an attorney appointed for them.
Now, does the State Department of Social Services or Child Protective Services have to have made some effort beforehand to prevent this from happening?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question, and I should have mentioned that first. There is a requirement in the law that the Department of Social Services prove that it has made, quote, reasonable efforts to prevent the removal from happening. And those reasonable efforts generally will involve some in-home services for the family, addressing whatever the need is. If, in fact, there's an underlying substance abuse issue, then there should be substance abuse treatment offered to the parent. Sometimes, if a case is actually going in need of some type of judicial oversight, then the less drastic alternative to removing the child from the home would be to enter an order called a protective order that tells the parents, you've got to go for substance abuse treatment, for example. You've got to abstain from drinking alcohol. You cannot use corporal punishment, et cetera.
And do you find in most cases the Child Protective Services has made some effort with the family beforehand, or do you find that that is the exception rather than the rule?
Well, recently, I've been very pleased. The counties in which I've tried these cases, I have found that they are making those efforts. They're making those efforts beforehand in most cases. I had one case, for example, where there were some pretty severe injuries sustained by a child as a result of some corporal punishment. And even though there was an emergency removal, that child went back home to mom within a period of a week or two, and there were services infused into that home. So I'm seeing in some of the counties around Richmond, recently, there seem to be more services in place.
So tell us, what's likely to happen at that first hearing? What's the process? What's the likely, what are the range of outcomes that are available to the judge at that first contested hearing where the parent actually shows up?
Well, the judge may find either that the county has not, or city social services has not met their burden of providing, making reasonable efforts to prevent the removal. And in that case, if in fact the court finds that the family is at risk and there's some evidence that there is a need for services, as I mentioned earlier, the court can enter a protective order, leaving the child in the home and requiring the parents to do certain things. Now, the court may find that even that level of intervention that a protective order requires is not merited. If the court makes a finding that no, there's no abuse or neglect here, it's not rising to the level of whatever the action is in the home, doesn't rise to the level of posing an imminent danger to the child, then the petition can be dismissed completely. Of course, if the court finds that social services has made reasonable efforts in the past, and despite those reasonable efforts, the problem still exists and the child is still at risk of imminent harm, then the court can remove the child from the home and first look to see if there's a relative that can take the child in. That's really the first priority after removal.
And do you find that the Child Protective Services or the court, after deciding that a child has to be removed, in most cases makes a serious search for another relative placement, or again, is that the exception rather than the rule?
Well, if you look at the statistics, Marty, statewide, it appears to be the exception. There are very, very, very few children who are in foster care with a relative placement. Now, I say if you look at the statistics, and if those statistics were really reflecting the number of kids going into a kinship care or relative care placement, we could make that conclusion. What I think is happening in a lot of courts throughout the Commonwealth is that if there is another relative, that relative files a separate private custody petition, and so the child isn't in this foster care at all. I don't know how often that happens. In my experience, I've seen it happen some, but not as often as I'd like to see.
Okay, now let's assume that a child is placed in foster care. It's not a relative placement. Where is the child likely to be placed, and what happens in court thereafter?
Well, hopefully the child is placed with the family who's been approved by the state to be a foster care family, who has been trained by the state or the county to act as a foster care family, and who has access to services. I say hopefully because we know statistically, and this is one of the main reasons we got such low marks from the recent, I think it was the Pew Commission.
I believe it was, yes.
Gave us such low marks for our child welfare system. If you look at the statistics, particularly for children who are 12 and older when they come into foster care, far too many of them are being placed in what we call congregate care. Now, congregate care can range from intensive psychiatric inpatient treatment to a group home. And a lot of these kids are not in need of intensive psychiatric treatment. They're going to group homes. And so hopefully that's going to change, but that's still what we've been seeing and why we got such bad
marks. And why are so many foster children, especially the 12 and older, going to congregate care instead of being placed with a foster family?
Simply put, we don't have enough foster families. And that really, it's really pretty simple. We have, until this past July, had one of the lowest rates of financial support for foster families in the entire country. it was abysmal. Now, we are improving that. We have already started to make improvements to it, and more improvements will be coming, and I think that will help. But we just don't have enough families willing to take kids, and those who are willing to take in kids are more likely to want younger children. We also see a lot of youth coming into the foster care system off of what we call delinquency petitions instead of abuse neglect petitions, meaning that's the juvenile court's word for a criminal warrant, is a delinquency petition. So you have kids who are getting into trouble. One of the things the court can do instead of sending them to detention, you know, juvenile jail, is to put them in foster care. And judges are doing that, and it's really overloading our system in some ways.
Well, I could certainly see how children who come through the delinquency petition might very well end up in congregate mm-hmm. care, but the ones that don't, the ones that come through the normal mm-hmm. abuse, neglect, removal petition,
yeah.
doesn't it cost about 5 to 10 times more to put a child in congregate care than in a foster care family? And if so, then why hasn't years ago the Commonwealth made the decision to drastically increase the rates paid to foster care families? That would save money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I can't tell you if it's 5 to 10 times more. I don't have that number in my head. But it's a heck of a lot more to serve a child in a congregate care facility than it is to serve a child in a family. And so certainly the increase in foster care family payments, as well as something that is again being phased in that will shift how the state reimburses localities for the money they spend on foster youth. The shift will be that the localities will be reimbursed at a higher rate when they place a child, to pay for a child going into a home, foster family home, than they will be when they send a child to a congregate care facility. So there's a lot in the works in terms of money issues that should make this better.
So it sounds like this was a problem that was building over years and years and probably will take years and years to solve.
Hopefully it will be solved more quickly than it will take fewer years to solve than it took to create. That's what everybody is hoping, but we'll see.
Thank you very much, Christy. We've been talking with Christy Mara at the Virginia Poverty Law Center about abuse, neglect, and foster care. Appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Ain't gonna let discrimination turn me around, turn me around.
We're back with the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's top three tips are about back child support. The first tip is that once it has been ordered and not paid for 30 days, child support becomes a judgment by operation of law. The second tip is that you can't undo, change, modify, or bankrupt child support that has been ordered and not paid for 30 days. All you can do is pay it. The third tip is that if you owe back child support, up to 65% of your income can be garnished in order to pay it. Although government benefits can't be garnished to pay most other debts, government benefits can be garnished to pay child support. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King. And for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. As the nation's economic crisis increasingly fixes blame on lending practices that were good for banks but bad for consumers, in Virginia, predatory lenders continue to operate with the same business model that reaps obscene profits and hurts low-income people. Join us next week when Patrick Getline and LaTanya Reed from the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy outline the problem of car title lending, present victim testimony on how car title loans are financial quicksand, and explain what to do about it. That's Law for the Rest of Us, next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wakebrand.